Mr. Justice, Hirabayashi versus United States and Karama are among the most important civil liberties cases of the last 30 years. Perhaps we could discuss these cases separately and take up Hirabayashi first. Would you describe the conference discussion?
Well, Hirabayashi, the conference discussion was conducted mostly by Stone, who spoke at great length about the war powers and what a dangerous position the United States was in following Pearl Harbor. This was the first war case and the discussion of war cases that this court had had, and Stone went into it in some detail, giving his views. Unpalatable though the action was, he didn't see how the court could look behind the judgment of the military. Didn't think it was necessary to reach the question of whether or not they could detain after immobilizing the Japanese citizens on the West Coast, and whether they could go beyond that. So he decided, in his view, that there should be a very narrow decision. But the tenor of his discussion was that the sky was practically the limit when it came to the war power. The others seemed to as I remember the discussion think the same. Certainly Black and Frankfurter did. Murphy didn't vote. He passed. All of us voted to affirm, except Murphy, who took did not record a vote at that time. Some of us, Rutledge and I, were less clear than Stone, Black, and Frankfurter. I have no distinct recollection as to Roberts' position, although he did vote to affirm.
In the Stone papers, there's a letter from Frankfurter to Stone in which he made several points, and I just wonder how these square with your recollection. One point was that Justice Black had told him that were he the commanding general of the Pacific Defense Area, that he would carry out the program despite an adverse court decision. Do you recall Justice Black's views being that strong?
I think that's approximately accurate, yes. There was a considerable discussion as to what power a court would have to give relief if it were attempted, whether in time of war, whether this situation would develop as it did at one time under Lincoln's administration, where the writ of habeas corpus was suspended. Black, I think, was pretty strong, as I remember the discussion, for um, a very broad interpretation of the military authority.
Did Justice Black ever approach you about your concurring opinion?
I don't think so. He may have said a few things to try to persuade me, but nothing. Unlike Frankfurter, never put on a drive to try to change a person's point of view.
When you first drafted your concurring opinion, I was wondering if you had as a primary purpose, as Brandeis apparently often did, persuading the majority to take or to modify their opinion by expressing some alternative point of view, as you did here. I think you had a reference to the possibility of habeas corpus as a means of securing justice in individual cases.
Yes, I was trying to get, at least for myself, some line of distinction so that there would not be just a wholesale grant of power to the military. I hoped that it would be written more narrowly, but it didn't have success in that regard.
Did Justice Frankfurter or Jackson or Stone ever discuss at any length your concurring opinion with you?
Stone did. Stone was... when Stone made up his mind, he's like a horse that knew that the oats were in a certain stall, and that's where he was going, and there's no turning him back. He was very solid in his position once he took his position. He was very nice and agreeable about making changes of a minor nature, but very seldom of any major nature. He did talk to me about why can't we get together and so on. Frankfurter rather made fun of it in a conference before the opinion came down. I don't recall any discussion with Jackson.
Was Frankfurter's point the one that he made in his letters to Stone, that he was afraid that there would be a flood of litigation in the lower courts?
Yes, that was one that is... All these things are on the verge of being non-justiciable because they deal with the actions of the commander-in-chief.
Well, should we move on perhaps to Korematsu?
Korematsu?
Okay. Regarding Korematsu, I was wondering whether the government's argument in that case was up to usual standards.
Well, as far as I know, it was. I don't recall any thing that would suggest that the government was making a weak argument, tongue-in-cheek, hoping to throw the... get the court to throw the case, reverse the case, and reverse this whole program of evacuation of the Japanese on the West Coast. When the case came up on cert, Stone didn't vote. He didn't vote to grant, he didn't vote to deny. Black voted to deny. myself voted to grant it. And after the conference discussion, there was a 5-4 decision to affirm. Stone and Black and Reed and Frankfurter were very clear on the matter. Rutledge as I recall was less clear but went along. Those who voted to reverse were Roberts and Jackson, Murphy and myself. Matter of fact, I prepared and circulated at one stage in the consideration of the case a dissenting opinion. But finally folded up and decided to go along with the majority. It was a very bothersome case, troublesome case, as indicated by the 5-4 decision, the 5-4 vote as originally taken at conference. And it was very much discussed, very much considered, very much debated up and down the halls of the corridors of the court.
Do you recall why precisely you decided to withdraw your dissent?
Some hesitation. It was. I had the fear all along of detention by the military. Point that we ultimately reached in the Endo case, but there we reached it on the question of the construction of the. Of the orders, as I recall, not on the Constitution, because I couldn't get a court for the constitutional decision. The court did not want to go beyond the construction of the regulations. It was. I don't know. I've regretted sometimes that I didn't file my dissent in Korematsu. This was a very difficult, troublesome decision. We did know that if at that time America was so disorganized after Pearl Harbor that if the Japanese army landed on the west coast, that they could march to the Rocky Mountains pretty easily. There was no no interior defenses once they landed, and if they landed in civilian garb. They could raise great havoc because nobody would know who was a Japanese soldier or who was an American citizen of Japanese ancestry.
But do you know, or at least do you have any theories, why Stone assigned the opinion of the court in Korematsu to Justice Black?
I don't know. Stone never consulted me. The conference discussion indicated, however, that Black was very much on Stone's side, very eloquent in defense of the power of the military to do what they did. And he had no doubts, reservations. So Rutherford Stone did it because he thought it would be desirable to have a liberal right in support of this. I don't know. I would suspect that that might have been the reason. But that's just on the basis of suspicion, not on the basis of anything the Stone said.
I was also wondering, this is a very minor picayune-ish point, but it's something that's interested me, that Justice Black, and apparently at Stone's request from the memorandum of the Stone papers, inserted a statement on page 221 of the court's opinion that the justices could not say that Korematsu would be taken to a detention camp if he obeyed the Army's order. The Japanese American Citizens League claimed in its amicus brief that Korematsu would be put in such a camp, and this, of course, was the Army's policy. And the government, in its brief, explicitly conceded that detention in the camp would follow Korematsu's obeying the order. I wonder whether there was any objection raised by any member of the court to the insertion of this statement.
As I recall, there was, because I think the court was divided. It seemed to some of us that there was Korematsu was under compulsion to leave, not as he chose in his own automobile, or on foot, or buying an airplane ticket on such airlines he might pick out, or by any crane he might choose, but he was being required to go from the area via an assembly center. And I think that division of due in the court is expressed in Black's opinion.
It seems, I wonder, just this might be a general question on this. Does the court often reject a statement of fact that both sides concede to be true?
Very seldom done. There was in this case the question of law, of course, whether detention connection with evacuation. So you could read this this particular information, I guess it was an information, not an indictment. You could read perhaps this information either way. I felt that this was the way that the court put it on page 221. Was not correct. It was not the fair way of reading the information or this record that we would have to consider the evacuation and the detention together. There had been Endo came down the same day, I believe, in the same volume, 323 U.S. I wrote Endo, as I said, that turned on the construction of the regulations. We had a considerable discussion. I had the desire to put it on the constitutional grounds, but I couldn't get a court to do that.
I was wondering, this may be an unfair question to ask, but With the benefit of almost 20 years of hindsight, do you think that Korematsu and Hirabayashi were wrongly decided?
I've had grave doubts. I had grave doubts at the time. I expressed qualifications to Hirabayashi in an opinion I filed, and I never published the dissenting opinion in Korematsu.
Or know if this has been part of a deliberate effort, at least on the, by some justices, to restrict these cases to their peculiar situation, or whether this has simply been a, here's a piece of dicta that fits in nicely?
I think it's probably the latter. I think Black, if you ask Black today what he thought of Korematsu, he'd be much, much firmer than I am. I've heard him talk in recent years about Korematsu and indicate with great emphasis why he thought that's a proper decision. I have more doubts about it. Mm-hmm. I've always had doubts about it. It's always a troublesome case, and I was sorry afterwards that I didn't file my dissenting opinion. Those cases, like the Korematsu and Hirabayashi, probably would have been decided the same way by any court that I have sat on in the 23 years. I think there would have been a majority for those. But it was, I think perhaps the greatest disappointment to me was the fact that you couldn't, the court wouldn't in endo go to the constitutional ground, but just stick to the conventional way of deciding a case, straining to construe a regulation to avoid a constitutional question. I'm the author of that, but I did it under the necessities of the situation. But it seemed to me to be a much more wholesome thing from the point of view of the court as an educating influence, just to say what you can, what you can't do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, particularly after deciding the others on constitutional grounds.
Yes.
This seemed to be an excellent place to draw a line.
But the citation of these cases, I think, is just for a literary phrase here and there, not any attempt to limit them. As near as I know, although I would certainly limit them, I think, in retrospect, and would have done things quite differently if I had to go back and do it over again. Does that about cover?
Yes, I think so. Following an hypothesis that has been developed by small group sociologists, Professor David Donelsky has attempted to apply this task-social leadership dichotomy to intra-court behavior. And I was wondering what your reaction to the value of this sort of study is.
Well, I think it has very little value for the reason that most judges are not, in my experience on the court, have not been evangelists for their own particular point of view. Frankfurter has been proselytizing. I mean, every case is for him a cause. He has a missionary zeal about even a stinking little tax case. He wants everybody to vote his way. Black has been a great campaigner for his point of view. Not across the boards indiscriminately like Frankfurter, but next to Frankfurter, I would say. And Stone was also a proselytizer, an evangelist for his point of view. But most of the other judges have not been. And most of them make up their mind. And then when they make up their mind, they think their job is over. That's always been my own particular philosophy. So I have never gone up and down the hall trying to get votes. And very few judges on this court have. Mm-hmm. To imagine a judge with an opinion going up and down the hall trying to persuade others to join it just isn't realistic. Mm-hmm. Except for Frankfurter preeminently, and to a lesser degree Black and Stone in the 23 years I've been here.
Would you say that Hughes was of this sort.
No. Hughes was...
Utterly circumspect, always proper, wholly impersonal, never arguing, never begging, never pounding the table, never denouncing another school of thought, never screaming, never raising his voice, never having near apoplectic fits at somebody's view that sounded to him stupid. Hughes, in his management of the conference, was very short, precise, succinct, and he would never take more than just a minute or two with every case. And then when that discussion of his was over, it would go around by seniority. Never once would he interrupt. Never once would he reply.